Okay. Just let it go.
Yeah.
Those are fried. Okay, I think we're actually going to get started here. This thing isn't for a PA, it's just for recording, so hopefully everybody can hear me okay. Well, thank you all for coming. This is the hometown crowd. I purposely set this one up with a really sympathetic audience, although I now have a couple of other gigs. I have one at the Tech Museum on Monday the 9th, and between now and then have one at the CIS Forum. So I'm kind of gradually stepping up through the levels of going public with this. I kind of had a weird experience a couple days ago. I put some stuff up on a website at metanature.org, and within about 24 hours, some blogger publication found it and like published it, sending me a notice after the fact that they'd done it. And, you know, then sent me the, like, forum posts about it. You know, I'm like, ready for that. So I may turn around and password protect that website. So I've got a lot of material to cover here, and I'm going to go ahead and try and march through it. This is the first time that I've really gone to PowerPoint, and so it's going to keep me kind of to my outline. And I'm not necessarily going to read the PowerPoint. I'm probably going to say something else while it's up there, so you need to pay attention to both things at once. So this first part is kind of just an introduction that I might not give to other audiences, kind of framing my attitude at some level towards what I'm doing and in some ways what I'm inviting other people to do with me. So this first piece is just a sort of set of observations about manifestation. And I've had some very interesting experiences manifesting things, you know. I'm fairly good at it. And I don't think that it's necessarily a sort of material activity, although obviously part of it is. So these first couple statements have a lot to do with the attitude that I'm trying to take in what I'm going to be presenting here. Because I'm essentially going to be talking about sort of the biggest, most abstract view of the world possible. And this, at one point I was reading probably like Be Here Now, and Ram Dass is talking about this interaction with his guru, and his guru says that everything's perfect, and whereupon Ram Dass recounts, you know, napalming babies in Vietnam and all these things, and his guru says, everything is perfect including your dissatisfaction with it. And, you know, that was a help, but I actually, a couple decades ago, started thinking about the state of the world and trying to imagine a scenario that would be big enough to encompass everything that's going on that seems to be wrong and have it turn out somehow to make sense. And so a lot of what I'm going to be talking about tonight is a result of having done that in detail for a couple decades now. So in thinking about the material that I have, I've actually decided that I probably need to put it out in three different books. The first one, which I'm not sure I'm actually going to entitle Meta Nature, but that's my working handle for it, is really rooted in a scientific view. It may take a kind of metaphoric view that's different than the way science usually likes to think about things, but it's a view that as long as you stay within that space, there's nothing that's going to make you tremendously uncomfortable if you're coming from a modernist perspective. It's not going to have a kind of archetypal or spiritual or even Jungian and no mention of synchronicity and none of that. The next book, which most of the audiences that are my friends don't really get excited about the story I'm telling until they get that one, is very archetypal and really thinking about things in terms of these bigger psycho-spiritual picture that we all kind of take for granted. And then the third one, ironically, is in some ways the most scientific in that it's about diagrams and maps of how to kind of teach and understand science, even in elementary school. But it would have with it the synchronicity stories involving time and number and this whole sort of matrix of magic that this stuff seems to come out of that would be totally challenging to the prevailing worldview. So that's kind of my current fantasy about how I'm going to put this stuff out. So I'm mostly going to talk about the first two books, but I'm going to give you just a little taste of stuff from the third one tonight, because the reason I picked this date is it's the 22nd anniversary of the discovery of this. And this was a result of an obsession that I spent about 3 months, my senior year in college, convinced, having studied pure geometry, that if one of the families of symmetry was there in Leonardo's drawing, basically the circle is unity and the square is the family four, and there are two other fundamental families of symmetry represented by the equilateral triangle and the pentagram. And the way this actually works is, for a long time there were these medieval teachings about the equilateral triangle touching the point where you stand. And I kept overlaying his drawing and trying to do that, and it wouldn't work. And I finally had to realize that it penetrates the ground, and it actually names the two spots where your feet stand, the width. And then the pentagram is actually quite easy. It's the arms up overhead, it's the arms outstretched. And pentagonal symmetry is all connected to the golden mean, which is there in organic form all over the place. But when I finally did a little sketch of this one night coming home from the studio and finally got it and realized that three families, three, four, and five, were there, and I looked at my watch after I was done, it was 3:45 a.m. And then I spent 7 years kind of putting it aside, because it's like this pure Platonic puzzle where you should be able to just start from number and shape and the whole thing would fold out of it. And I couldn't figure out how high to place the arms. And I finally, after 7 years, realized that if you take half of the square and you take the golden mean of that, it positions the height of the arms. And when you do that, the system sinks together at the crown, at the center of the circle, and down here at the base, the first chakra. And then you get these cross points that are mostly the pentagonal system that pick out the chakras, although it picks out more than seven. There's actually quite a number of chakras, and I think seven is picked for other reasons. So I don't want to say really anything more about that tonight. I should say one more thing about it. This drawing and the experience of discovering it is central to an attitude that has allowed me to pursue the rest of what I've been working on. And it's this kind of sense that there is an intelligent coherence to existence, and that if you go at it with the intention that you are looking for this and the patience to kind of wait to discover it, it will reveal itself to you, and that it's built into the nature of the system for it to be there. So this was actually one of three projects. I'm not going to leave this up for very long, but the next one involves chemistry. This is the standard way of looking at the periodic table of the elements. If you're not familiar with it, it looks kind of daunting. And my father was a chemist, and I grew up with chemistry, and I thought about it differently, and I was finally able to articulate how I think about it. This is the same chart. It's a little hard to look at because it's got the transition and intertransition elements folded into additional spirals, but if we take those out, it becomes very clear. That's the eightfold nature of chemistry. And except for the metals and the transition elements, that's really the symmetry that the whole thing operates on. And there's a really fundamental idea that you get when you look at it this way that you don't get in the other renditions of it, and that is that the purple spheres going upwards, those are the noble gases. Those have all of their electron shells filled, so they won't react with anything. The green ones coming the other way are the elements that only have four electrons. So they really love to couple up with all kinds of things. They're the building blocks for everything. The first one coming out from the center is carbon, and the second one is silicon. This is just the inner ones, just the first couple of revolutions labeled. So the C is carbon, and the SI is silicon. And the little white thing right near the center is hydrogen. And as you go one side or the other of the noble gases, you get molecules that are atoms that either have one electron and really want to give it up, or are missing one electron in their shell and really want an electron. And so things on either side of the noble gases will hook together to make salts. So for instance, this is sodium, and this is chlorine. And so you put sodium and chlorine together, you get sodium chloride, table salt. And so these alkali earth elements over here, lithium, sodium, potassium, magnesium, and chlorine, fluorine, but also oxygen will hook together. And once you start seeing that just inherent symmetry, you can actually grok chemistry with this diagram without really not knowing very much. You don't have to do any math. Now, there's also a lot to do with how big things are, just whether they'll physically fit together. And so what I did is I made the size of the sphere proportional to the known radius of the atom in its rest state. But I just want to point out one more thing before we go past this one. And that is, so there's hydrogen, carbon, and silicon right on the central axis. So carbon is the basis of life, and silicon is the basis of rock. Now, along with silicon, aluminum is also very important in rock over here. And life is pretty much completely based on carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen. This little triangle in here. Now, you get a little bit of phosphorus, and you know there's other things involved, but most of what we're going to talk about to do with biology, chemically, is all just those four elements trading back and forth. And this lets you see why they would be that way, in a way that you don't usually get from the way things are taught in school. So I've showed anatomy, this was chemistry, the one I'm not showing tonight is Newtonian physics. I made some symbols for teaching a kindergartner Newtonian physics. What I'm mostly going to talk about tonight is the big picture on the planet. And time and what we're up against. Because we are living in a time that is absolutely unique in the history of life on the planet. It's not quite absolutely unique in the history of life on the planet. It's unique in the history of human life on the planet. There's some precedence at other times, and I'm going to talk about that. But what I've tried to do here is to distill five kind of key categories that describe a lot of what's going on and really describe what we should be paying attention to. Because I think an awful lot of times we lose track of which things really matter, and it seems like there's a myriad of things to think about, and like which buckets really are the ones that count. Incidentally, I don't think the fifth one makes that ranking, but I think it's where the opportunity may be. So the first is population. This is showing about 1,000 years of human population. And, you know, it just spikes. You don't have to say much about it to get it. This is a different time scale and a different, you know, axis of time to height. And where they start diverging is 2000 now. And this is showing where population could go. It's not a very good slide, but we're at about 6 billion now, and you know the lowest one of these things shows peaking around 8, and some of these are just going off to infinity, which can't actually happen. We'll crash something else before that happens. But what I want to show you is that these things, you know, by 2050, these things are out of control. That's our lifetime. It's our problem. It's on our watch. This is another diagram showing 100 years with a variety of big computer models about where population could go. Again, the most optimistic one here has the thing peaking a little under 8 and then coming back down to where it is now in 100 years. Now, none of these assume outbreaks of disease, which is usually what happens when a population gets out of control in nature. at some point. And you know, there was Marpa virus in Africa last week, and, you know, bird flu. There's any number of things that could punch a hole in this, but it's kind of hard to pray for, you know, plague to take out the human population. This is not so much about the number, but about this idea that at some point the population has to peak. We have to get, it has to be an S-curve. It can't just take off forever, and the lower that peak is, the better off we are. Now, it's not just population that has to be characterized that way. This is a different kind of peak. This is in the news now with people with tremendous, you know, consternation about it. To me, it's the most optimistic thing of all the stuff I'm going to show you here that we know is going to happen. This is peak oil. This has to do with the idea that the fossil fuel supply, the period where we're going to extract the most of it the fastest is right about now. And as soon as we get on the other side of that, the price is going to go up a lot. And what we've seen so far is not that. I mean, it's not that kind of price. In Europe, gasoline is effectively $7 a gallon once we depreciate the dollar. It used to be $5. But I actually see peak oil as one of the optimistic drivers. This is a pessimistic view of peak oil. I'm basically trying to put forward something that's other than this. This is the Green Party sort of showing the caveman in 1830. It's a little off, but, you know, and then peak oil, you are here. And then, you know, 2150, it's the caveman again. You know, it's a sort of blipped. So if we look at, in spite of the United States, if we look globally at energy consumption per capita, since the 70s, that little bit of price shock drove so much efficiency that per capita energy use has actually flattened, but the population is still growing, so net use is still growing. So that's some good news. It shows what actually a tiny little bit of price signal could do in terms of stopping the madness or slowing it down. Although I don't want to characterize it as madness. It's normal behavior of biological systems to do just what we're doing. This is a little diagram then about CO2, which is the other thing pushing on us in the other direction. Even if we had all the oil we wanted, or all the coal, and you burned it the way we're burning it now, you would put so much CO2 in the atmosphere that would cause serious troubles, and it is, and it's very frightening. So this is showing what Canada is going to do. They're, unlike the U.S., they're trying to adapt. They're trying to flatten their emissions, the blue line. This is the atmospheric CO2 level. And this is on about a 1,000-year time scale. I didn't show you the one that goes like 160,000. There actually have been peaks as high as ours, but we've just gone off scale. I mean, the highest peak before was about in here, and we're just taking off. And what this doesn't show is methane, which is even worse greenhouse gas and is even more dangerous levels than CO2. So, you know, except for the Coal Council, everybody understands this, but nobody really knows yet what to do about it. But of all those things, by far the most dangerous trend is none of the ones I've just shown you. It's the one that gets the least press right now. And that is just the total net destruction. It's not even consumption, but destruction of nature, of natural resources. We use a very small percentage of what we destroy as we're going around the planet. And the UN report just came out saying we're using 60% of the output of the biosphere for human purposes right now. And a few years ago when I started talking about this, it was 40%. It's still accelerating. And this is just a little thing. It's hard to find graphics on the web about it. You go to CO2, you find everything you could imagine to steal. But you Google image on this, and there's almost nothing. This is something from somebody trying to sell wood made out of straw. And so they've got this little thing about when the wood's going to cross over and no longer meet demand. But it's there in everything. So it's really the overconsumption and just rampant destruction of theoretically renewable resources that's the thing that is most dangerous on the planet. And, you know, this is a map of biodiversity hotspots, but those are just the places where people have really focused because they're so rich that they're trying to preserve those spots. Again, on a mass basis, in terms of the weight, the mass of things, 95, I think it may be as much as 98% of what we consume in the industrial process is waste. We're talking 3 to 5% product versus waste. And so what this all adds up to is what's really at stake is that within our lifetime, we will either do something different or we will destroy the future for all future generations. If we continue to just eat the planet this way, there is essentially a very impoverished future for any future humans, because we will destroy the biosphere and destroy it with huge numbers of people that will then just degenerate into the most violent imaginable chaos and probably destroy most of what's left. And unfortunately, so far, most of the people critiquing this aren't able to imagine much other than that. And I think that's the problem. So the metaphor, really, if you look for biological metaphors, the metaphor is, are we going to behave basically like a mold or a bacteria in a petri dish that will just eat the available food until it comes to the edge of the dish and then crash? Or is there something else going on, or could be going on, where you could see the process we're engaged in as analogous to a growing embryo in an egg that's using up the resources like crazy to try and build something that's going to do something else? And that's basically the only possibility we've got, and it's a very exciting one. Fuller was the first person to really talk about this, to see that what was coming down the road and to talk about the possibility that we could really make it, and that we could make it by essentially getting smarter. So now I'm going to kind of launch in. That was just to frame the situation. And I need to do that to get people on the same page, because I don't know who knows what, and I don't think most people really have that grasp of what's going on. So what I'm going to do now is go back over the very long-term history of evolution and talk about some other points in the past that are remarkably similar in some ways to what we're facing now. So if we start with life, this is sort of a little overview of what I'm going to talk through, the various points. So when life first came on the scene, it was very hard to get an image for this, and they got. It's not too far off the creationist model. It was good. If you could have life, then you provide some food for them. So there was basically a soup of molecules, and somehow they self-assembled into something that we see as life. And for a long time, there was enough energy in that soup for life to just eat the energy in those molecules. And eventually, a life form came along that figured out how to arrange carbon and a few other molecules, a few other atoms, to capture photons, so that you could take the energy from the sun and directly use it to build life. And in the process of doing that, it released oxygen. And the oxygen first was taken up literally rusting all of the iron in the whole lithosphere. So the rocks had to all be cycled above ground and underground, and all of it had to be churned until the oxygen had basically finished oxidizing all of the iron available in the crust. And after it finished doing that, it spiked. And we had the analog of what we're having now. We had a chemical imbalance in the atmosphere, only that one, instead of being too much CO2, was too much oxygen. And the atmosphere got so oxygen-rich that some people speculate that the organisms were literally spontaneously bursting into flame. Now, they wouldn't have been trees and so on. They would have been much smaller organisms, is the best image I could get. But what's important to notice here is that both of these events so far, the dawn of photosynthesis was in response to kind of an energy crisis, as far as we can tell, where you needed energy and the soup wasn't doing it anymore, and you had to sort of get hold of this new source of energy from photons. And then in response to oxygen, life invented respiration, because the oxygen was actually a very high energy source. There was a lot of energy in that oxygen. That's why things would burn with it. And once respiration and photosynthesis both existed, then the higher life forms that we know today, that evolution could proceed. And that resulted in something called the carbon cycle, which is actually just one of a number of cycles where these basic elements that I pointed to before are traded back and forth in a balanced loop between different kinds of life forms. And the carbon cycle involves trees and plants and animals, although actually the animals are a tiny part of it. The trees are taking in carbon dioxide, building carbohydrates, and putting out oxygen. And the animals are breathing in oxygen and breathing out carbon dioxide. Although it's mostly not animals, it's mostly fungi and organisms in the soil that are the major part of the balance with green plants. So this is like a little diagram of the net carbon flows in the world, and they're huge. The little amount that fossil fuels account for compared to the rest of what's going on is small. But it's big enough that over time it throws a very delicately balanced system out of whack. And actually, we started unbalancing it about 10 or 12,000 years ago when we started doing agriculture. Agriculture was the beginning of the measurable movement towards more CO2 in the atmosphere. And with fossil fuels, it's just, you know, as I showed before, spiked, and especially with the acceleration of industrial technology. But it's really important to notice that basically, all of our fossil fuel technology is like hyperanimals. It's over with us on the respiration side of the balance sheet with plants on the other side. And we keep reducing the amount of plant cover while raising the amount of demand for balance from it. So it's also interesting, though, if you look at the evolution of that fuel process, of industrial use of fuels, they've been steadily moving from solids towards liquids and gases. And as you go from wood to peat to coal to oil to natural gas to hydrogen, each one of those has less carbon per hydrogen until you get to hydrogen and there's nowhere else to go. Remember in our spiral, it was at the center. It's the smallest, lightest element that exists. If you use it to transport energy, you're transporting energy on the most compact, lightest weight element possible. This same argument also suggests that lithium, this big looking thing right next to it, it's only got a molecular weight of 3, that we're already seeing in our laptop batteries, the lithium ion batteries, are also going to be the other way along with hydrogen to carry energy around in matter. These are the two lightest weight elements that can carry an electrical charge or carry a chemical charge, chemical potential. So helium in between them, that HE, is inert. That's a gas. So again, I've been talking about carbon, the green circle, and oxygen, this blue circle over here. It's oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and then nitrogen is important plant. But again, it's this little triangle where all this stuff's going on. And nature has been very much about figuring out how to put the puzzle together in this really elegant way. At the same time, this is a statement about humans' relationship to nature. And pretty much, while some people might dispute, you know, just how frightening it was to different cultures, at some level, built into our, you know, our very visceral attitude is this thing where nature was something threatening and overpowering. And for it to switch from being something threatening and overpowering to something fragile that we have to take care of in one generation, the miracle is not that there's a lot of people who don't get it yet. The miracle is that there's some of us who do. You know, it's such a huge, just archetypal change to take this on board. And I think it's much easier for kids than for older people. You know, you sort of imprint things when you're young, and somebody growing up now imprints this, and people grew up before, just have a really hard time believing that it could be possible, that we could destroy nature. So this is just coming back to those five, actually it's a different representation of the five, list of five, kind of double counts fuels here. But it's five key things that have to change, and quickly. And they all have to change. You can't make it without doing all of them. Now, I'm just going to leave this up for a second and go on. We talked again that the destruction of nature is really the same as the resource consumption. So that's really the same piece there. CO2 is the global warming. Population growth is what drives the whole thing. And fossil fuels are tightly connected to CO2. So it's, even though it's 5, it's really collapses to about 3. On the other hand, if these trends, like for instance population, decelerate and go towards a plateau, then they have to turn out not to be kind of log curves taking off to infinity. They have to turn out to be what's called an S-curve. And the S-curve implies that there's some sort of plateau, or what's in math called an asymptote, just the way we sort of came out of nature in the most remote place in time and started accelerating, and now at our moment it feels like the acceleration is vertical. If it's going to slow down, it's not actually going to go backwards, it's going to have to slow down and go towards something. And it implies this other kind of plateau, which I call metanature. And the idea is that it has to turn out to be kind of an octave of nature. And in trying to explain this to people, and what I find really useful about this kind of model is it's not a model that says, oh, we have to go backwards. It says we have to go forwards differently than you've understood before. And that everything you've done up to this point has actually created the velocity to allow us to go where we need to go. But now that you've had this illuminating experience of seeing past the present into the future, it instructs you about how to adapt and how to take the momentum of what you've done and go in a slightly different direction that will take us in a very different direction. It's like in those population diagrams. What happens at this moment sends us veering off in very different directions for very little change. So I call this point the neck of the hourglass. And really that whole list collapses to two issues as we go through the neck of the hourglass. And the point is, you have to do both of them. You can't do just one and make it. So on the one hand, preservation of biodiversity is paramount. And it's what most of the culture doesn't get and doesn't value right now. Future generations will measure us by how much biodiversity we preserve for them. Because this is going to be the one thing that can't be recreated no matter what, as far as we can tell. Even with genetic engineering, it doesn't look like we're going to get very far beyond the raw starting product we have. At the same time, the intuition of the sort of go, 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 there's no limits to growth industrialist has a place. It's just misguided because they're not actually seeing the problem they have to solve. We do actually have to have another industrial revolution, and we have to do it very fast. And what we have to do, and in the time we have to do it, is nothing compared to the last industrial revolution. We're under far more pressure this time. Because if we don't achieve a climax technology, our sheer numbers will destroy the biosphere. There's no way around it. So the family tree of life is the one true measure of wealth. But at the same time, we need to make this leap to a new level of technology. And both things are equally critical in traversing the neck of the hourglass, which is also the point of inflection. In an S-curve, it's called the point of inflection, and I've kind of made it into a little bit of a 3D representation to try and get the two ideas pulled together. So this is some text that I wrote quite a number of years ago, and it's a little heavy, but it's actually quite precise in what I'm saying. We are undergoing a point of inversion in matter and culture. From this point on, our technological evolution in matter may be guided by the recognition of the potential for a climax technology, a state of metanature, a state as harmonious as nature in the coherence of its design, which, like nature, is the realization of a potential already inherent in the puzzle that is matter, a state that, unlike nature, may only bring itself into being through the intervention of humans, and yet one that exists fully in potential prior to any manifestation in matter, an inherent property implicit in the coherence of basic space, a state which unfolds inevitably out of the most fundamental harmony and symmetry possible in matter, a state which, like nature, is not static, but always evolving, with a coherence and beauty expressed through the perfected energetic efficiency. And that was actually written on the winter solstice right before Y2K. A point I'll come back to. So again, silicon right below carbon is like the next octave of carbon. So when we make photovoltaics that capture photons out of silicon, the way nature made photosynthesis out of carbon, we're very much making the next octave. We don't tend to see things in that big a frame. We still tend to think, oh, it could go lots of different places, lots of things are possible. There is a certain inevitability and limit to what we are achieving, but what can be achieved. Also, photovoltaics, as much as the economists tell us they're not efficient enough at 10% efficient, are an order of magnitude more efficient than photosynthesis at about 1% efficient. Although photosynthesis can reproduce itself without high temperature or pressure or pollutants or any number of other things, so there's certain advantages to it. But still, there's an incredible breakthrough as we get to photovoltaics. There's a reason why both of these things are doing this. This is a diagram of the spectral spread of energy, and this big spike is the wavelength where energy from the sun comes in a very narrow wavelength. And then the low thing is the wavelength, the colors of light, heat, that we re-radiate back out into space. And for people that understand systems theory and entropy, it's actually the spread between your energy source or your source of order and your sink for heat that you need to run a heat engine or essentially an information engine. And so it's the ability to get very focused heat from one very particular point, the sun, and dump very disordered heat out in all directions to dark space that makes it possible for us to live in that energy flux. And both photosynthesis and photovoltaics do it. And in fact, all three of the energy sources, solar itself, wind is just the kinetic disturbance of air molecules because of the heat of the sun. And then biomass is just like solar, it's the other side of nature absorbing photons. Those are the three primary energy sources. Now, up to this point, biomass has looked really kind of frightening. And there's actually a discovery that I happen to be privy to, almost nobody knows about it, that is a miracle that basically takes off two of those points on the list that I described, but we're going to have to deploy it now from, you know, they're doing it at kilogram levels in the lab, and we've got to take this thing out to where it's being used, you know, at the largest industrial scale of the planet. What it does is it allows you to combine biomass and coal and put less CO2 in the atmosphere than you took out with the biomass. And it puts all the carbon into a fertilizer that will put carbon back in the soil, because the other huge imbalance that industrial civilization has caused besides the air is the soil. We've been depleting carbon from the soil. And it also creates hydrogen, and you can use it to create biodiesel. So it's a technology that we can use for 50 or 100 years as a bridge with coal. We can use it to actively remove CO2 from the atmosphere and take that spike back down, because it's going to be not enough to just stop it. We're going to have to go the other way very actively to avoid catastrophe. But everything about this industrial level builds out the long-term sustainable biomass technology that we'll need in the future. And biodiesel is a very easy bridge, because like half the vehicle fleet in Europe right now is diesel, and clean rail diesel is coming really fast. So that lets us go to something, you know, very quickly as we build this out, while building a hydrogen economy and infrastructure that we'll eventually use to go to fuel cell vehicles. This is a sort of simplistic diagram of what it does. You're taking, on the side, you're taking like a crop, but you're not, unlike corn, you know, gasohol, you're not taking the food grade part, you're taking the real waste. And you're putting it in a vessel, heating it, you can heat it with waste heat from a factory, you're basically driving off hydrogen, you're making this car, you take some nitrogen out of the air, and you're making basically a high carbon fertilizer that you put back in the soil. And you're putting more carbon back in the soil than you took out, which is one of the huge problems with a lot of biomass, is you start pulling the nutrients out of the soil and pretty soon you've destroyed agriculture trying to make energy. This will let us actually do it and restore the soil. This is a more detailed diagram for those that know some chemistry. That's the formula up at the top for making the what they're calling ECOS. This it's an ammonium bicarbonate fertilizer on charcoal. And also about 70% of the hydrogen coming off is excess that you can use for either making other things like biodiesel or using a fuel cell. So this discovery alone makes it possible for me to be optimistic about two of the key points really on the chart, although there's huge questions about how fast we can build this out. And that's really a huge part of what we're up against. This is another example of sort of trying to concretize what I'm talking about with metanature. This is some chemistry that was discovered as a result of Buckminster Fuller first doing the geometry. And it was only because we sort of had the theoretical geometry that the chemists started thinking about, would this be possible in chemistry? And what it's done is it's made structures. These are spheres, but you can make tubes out of this stuff. And they're another leap beyond carbon fiber in their strength to weight ratio. And they're an absolute limit in how you can put matter together. I mean, this is what I'm visualizing when I make statements like that little piece I read you about metanature. All of this sort of this non-Euclidean geometry that people, you know, my age and younger are finally starting to understand is not terribly operative at our scale, but it allows you to understand what's done at the nanoscale really well. And this is where this stuff is going to finally be applied. So these kinds of materials will ultimately let us do things very, very differently than what we're doing now in terms of the weight of a vehicle or the weight of things that we, the size of things that we have to deal with. The other big approach is what's called biomimicry, popularized by Jeanine Benyus, which is actually looking at nature as a source for design. And there's amazing things coming out of doing this. And it's one of the arguments for people who don't get it on biodiversity. It would be like we were burning down the library at Alexandria and we just barely learned to read. We just don't understand what's out there. But it's, you know, for people like me, a pretty clear article of faith that embedded within the design of nature is everything that we need to learn from to design the next octave, which will let us arrange matter and completely solve all of our needs. It's built into the system if we just get it. So the question is, this is like very end state, you know, out there. How do we get there from here? So this was an outline that I put together kind of in a hurry, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but it kind of is a little tour of like which things need to happen in roughly what order. It's not all order because it's partly categorized, so I just had to sort of pick something and put them first. Although the first one is there's no question that pray for rapid, steady, high increases in the price of oil and energy. I mean, this is, for human survival and well-being, this is the single biggest driver. And when the price of oil goes up, cheer and know that we have a chance. These next three items I'm going to unpack in more detail. The first one that will be driven by that, we saw it in the 70s, it'll happen very fast, is just other efficiency that comes from the price of energy going up. Everything from insulation to light bulbs to motors. Motors are a huge source. To ducts, to plumbing, to pumps, to pipes. All the really mundane, not sexy stuff that has nothing to do with energy technology is where a lot of the big savings are. They're very labor intensive. They help put people in jobs. And, you know, it's good actually for the economy in a lot of ways. But we're terrified of going there. The other thing is the thing that everybody gives lip service to and we don't spend any money on really, which is R&D and deployment of alternatives. Wind is already competitive with coal. It's already underpricing coal. Municipal bond issues to buy solar is starting to drive demand for the supply so much that it's getting hard to get. As these things kick into gear, it's amazing how much the people who are sort of advocates for the economic solution and the wisdom of the market fail to really have any faith in it or to really look backwards at how fast industrial transformations have happened given the right motivation. And, you know, we get these projections of current trends and say, oh, no, we could never get there in time, we could never do enough. The one thing we have going for us is the same thing that's going against us, which is this incredible out-of-control acceleration of our system. And we have to harness that to make this switch very fast or die, which means we might do it. The other thing that doesn't get a lot of lip service is tremendously control. Right now, we're basically eating oil. Agriculture has tremendous inputs of oil and tremendous destruction of cropland. And so one of the things that the increased price of energy will do is transform agriculture away from the sort of industrial model that we have. Or the transformation of that model, we're still going to need to move this fertilizer coming from these plants out to sort of, again, try and restore the soil that we've almost destroyed. But this bottom line one is also very important. One of the things that's going to happen is a tremendous upsurgence in residential scale food production. As the price of food goes up, you know, it's also something people often like to do. The most critical thing, though, that's not being done fast enough is not on the energy side. It's to do with everything else. And when we hear people talking about recycling right now, it's basically been driven to the front of our attention because it was inconvenient for municipal landfill managers to have to deal with the stuff. And so they brought in recycling. Most of the recycling we're doing right now is to a large degree still kind of senseless. The kind of recycling that we need to do offsets demand from the biosphere. If we throw stuff in the landfill, it doesn't matter. We will mine it in a decade or two. What matters is how much or how little we destroy nature, and that is the one thing that matters. So if you want to use less of something that required destruction of the biosphere, that is really important. If you want to worry about whether or not your little drink container made it into the recycling bucket, put your attention somewhere else. Except for the one thing we don't pay attention to, batteries probably. They're toxic and things like that. But this last item, I was involved as an industrial designer a decade ago, and there was still a huge premium on the proliferation of different plastics formulas because you make money selling an engineered plastic, not selling the same plastic. And what we're actually going to have to engineer is a few plastic formulas that we can actually recycle back into the same plastic so that we can really get a closed loop where we're saving energy and we're totally getting outside the material flow. We're starting to get there with a few things. This is a huge one, and it's the one that people are least interested in hearing about. I didn't highlight it on those lists tremendously, but whenever you get in discussion of what's going on and what's blocking all the things that we would rationally need to do, you immediately get back to the financial markets. People blame the corporations. It's nothing to do with the corporations. It's the logic of the global financial system. It's like this doomsday machine that we built, and it's running out of control on its own, and nobody's in charge. Nobody has the capacity to decide to change it, really. Although it's quite plausible that some of these other drivers will throw us into crises that will, you know, surface the instability in that thing. And then the question is going to be whether we have alternatives in place that we can essentially sort of build a safety net with so that when that thing goes into fibrillation, we can fall into this net of something that's going to have other implications. I'm not going to say a lot about economics, it's a whole other talk, but very briefly, the two big things in my analysis are the fact that money is borrowed into existence with interest attached, which creates essentially like a game of musical chairs that everybody's losing at all times, no matter how much money you have. The experience of all people is like running around frantically to not be the one caught out. You can't just relax and stay still in the system, as everybody knows, but nobody knows why. Well, it's built into our game rules. And it also forces everybody who has any nature to turn it into commodities and consume it to get cash. And that's what's actually driving the insanity more than the sheer number of people right now. The other thing is what's called externalities, the idea that if you have a cost that you can foist on the rest of society and not have to put into your own pricing, and you can get away with it, you win. So there's a tremendous tendency of a lot of players to, you know, dodge costs or buy politicians that will allow them to, you know, dodge costs. And that is, you know, a really dysfunctional thing for the people who claim that the market will fix everything. As long as we have that, the market's not going to work. This is what I was talking about with Aprita. This is the active reduction of CO2 in the biosphere. A tremendous amount of the projected extinction has to do with global warming. One of the really key things to remember about all those horrible graphs I showed you is that a lot of them are graphs projected linearly into the future. The whole point is that things can't go on linearly. There has to be a huge change soon. But while we get terrified and frightened, as we should, of those projections, we should bear in mind that things have not happened yet. And we still are at this moment where if we can do something completely unpredicted and jump the system to a different state of order, we can avert a lot of the worst of the projections. Not all. There'll still be some really painful and tremendous losses that are happening every day. But Aprita is one of the examples of a place where we have now at least the knowledge of what we can do to deal with really two of the biggest issues that everybody thinks are just unsolvable. This is the one that's probably most critical, next to just preservation of the biosphere now, keeping things from being killed, extinguished, and building the technology, but that's a little slower track. This matters tremendously because every time you put another person on the planet, there's this long clock and their whole reproductive cycle, and all that's set in motion. So the sooner you intervene effectively on this one, the better. There's one positive little note I heard. I heard a recording of Ehrlich on the radio the other night. And he sort of mentioned in passing that in the 70s, the birth rate in the United States suddenly stabilized. Something went down, you know, to less than replacement. And it actually sort of lost in the graph. But it actually happened a lot quicker than anybody thought. It just sort of all of a sudden flipped. And, you know, that was about the time that his book, The Population Bomb, came out. And all of a sudden, and it's not that everybody in the population knew it. I think there is a kind of 100th monkey phenomenon, where when something enters into the global consciousness, it does, you know, kind of throw a little bit of a switch. And that's one of the things I pray, is that these statisticians projecting these numbers do not account for that possibility. They just crunch the numbers in a computer. So the other thing that's in here is that it's really well understood that giving in the third world, giving women control of contraception secret from men, has a huge effect immediately. Because they know that more kids leads to more infant mortality and less survival for them. And the men tend to be very machismo and think these kids are my life insurance and look how good I am as a man, you know. And you go to the UN and you talk to all these male delegates and they won't go anywhere on population. But if you go on the ground and you make it available, where that's happened, things have shifted and the well-being of people has shifted because it does help everybody to have smaller families and better. And, you know, as we build out this technology, it's going to be from that we're able to bring things to people all over the world that makes life better for them. And I'm not necessarily talking about just high-tech technology. This is another one that I think people don't allow for enough. An awful lot of the demand we put on resources is geared to the insanity of the way we think we have to live right now because of the whole complex game rules of society. If, you know, you politicians, jobs, jobs, jobs. Nobody wants a job. Everybody wants an income. And at least most of the jobs, you know, there are a few people that do something, you know, as a doctor or something, they enjoy their work. But most of the nonsense that people do, you know, it's compulsory. They hate it. You know, they have to sit in this metal box on a piece of asphalt for hours, and you're breathing all these hydrocarbons, you know, to get to this cubicle, to be put in a veal fattening pen, to look at a screen sending, you know, radiation at them, and go home and do it again. I mean, it is senseless. You know, if you know, anthropologists from Mars showed up, they would look at this and go, what is wrong with these people? You know, they're busily destroying their planet, you know, making themselves miserable. So, you know, one of the nice consequences of the system radically restructuring itself is you could get rid of a lot of nonsense and put a lot less demand on the resources that we think we don't have enough of. So this is like a little list of some of the positive, relatively low-tech things that can actually be done to push back on what we think is hopeless with the advancing deserts and these other things that we think, oh, there's nothing we can do about it. If we could simply redeploy human labor a little bit and give the knowledge of how to do it, it's been demonstrated in Brazil, where you have the rainforest being cut down by poor peasants doing slash and burn, and they're cutting a hectare a year and wasting the land and going and doing it again. With the right knowledge, that family can live sustainably on 3 hectares forever. You just have to know how to reestablish tree crops. Much of the Amazonian jungle was sort of farmed to begin with, we're finding. So there's, and you know, what we called wild land in North America was mostly managed by the native peoples here. So there's a very different aesthetic towards a relationship to land that has a lot to do with not just preservation, but restoration. And that when we turn the corner, those things are available to us. And we have a huge knowledge of relatively low-tech things that allow us to do it. This is a little more high-tech, although a lot of the things used are still pretty simple, ways of cleaning up the mess we've made. I actually put those very low on the list. It's important. We're going to need to turn around and do it, but it's not the place to focus now. We need to be focused on, you know, the house burning down, with some exceptions. But a lot of the stuff, if we can make the other transitions I'm talking about, the stuff will take care of itself. So the petrochemical industry is going to go away. It's you know, a question of when or how fast. And this is another one that people are not looking at, which is the active redeployment of endangered species into human cohabited areas. That if we're going to preserve nature, it's not going to be just by preserving pristine nature. It's going to be by creating corridors and hedgerows and belts and transforming the suburbs into a habitable place, and by basically figuring out how to make our inhabitation compatible with nature. You know, there's a few species for which that may be really impossible, but there's a lot better that we could be doing by simply paying attention. And we're not even beginning to think about it. Well, there are a few groups are, but it's mostly not making the radar yet. This is, again, stuff about relatively cheap, low-cost things we could do in having water, which is a huge issue people are talking about. It's been privatized, but there's a lot of things we could do to go the other way using mostly knowledge and human labor. This is a thing that goes back to that chemistry I talked about, that one column that had chlorine in it. Those are called the halogens. If you go down the list of toxic and poisonous chemicals, except for the heavy metals, almost every chemical that's a problem has halogens in it. If you simply take them out of chemistry, you solve almost all of the toxic problems. It's not that hard to figure out. Oops, one of these two. Oops. Fuck. Yep. Okay, so again, I come back to the economic game rules. This is the one thing that everybody thinks, you know, people say we're materialists. We're not materialists, we're symbolists. We live in this abstract space called money. And it completely dominates our cognitive landscape. People are so completely hypnotized by it that most people are incapable of seeing reality when it's right in front of their face. And you know, it's simply amazing. And at the same time, anybody who is thinking materially about what's going on keeps running into the game rules of the money system, going, well, we could solve all these things if it wasn't that the game rules were so dysfunctional. So that concludes the first book with a little more attitude than I'll probably put in it. That entire argument was pretty much based, as you probably heard, more than you wanted, in chemistry and biology and, you know, the hard sciences, but with a little different kind of attitude towards them. This next piece is sort of what follows from it. And a couple of observations. The first one is that virtually all cultures have some tradition where it is understood that for an individual to arrive at a state of greater integration and spiritual realization, that person must first undergo a process of psycho-spiritual death and rebirth. This takes on all kinds of forms, but that generalization of the statement, as far as I've been able to determine, is pretty good. I haven't done the hard research yet to prove it, but I suspect there are other people who would be able to, possibly sitting in this room. At the same time, numerous cultures all have prophecies that seem to foretell either the end of the world or the birth of a new world, or both in the same prophecy. And you can kind of, this is not a very good list, I just sort of, you know, the white buffalo, a lot of people know about. I have not explored them, but I'm told there's Australian Aboriginal myths that talk about this. The Dogon people have this thing about Sirius. There's a number of other ones in the African subcontinent. It's huge interest in the Mayan calendar, both the real Mayan calendar and Jose. But the Mayan calendar is actually the, as far as you can tell, like Olmec or Toltec calendar. It goes way, way back, and nobody really understands. It's really crappy for predicting the cycles we live in terms of the solar cycle, but it's really good for super long-term time. The dawning of the Age of Aquarius is the sort of Western representation of this idea of the great year, the procession of the equinoxes. It's basically a 26,000-year cycle for things to go around, which incidentally, if you figure a quarter of that is about 6,500 years, the oldest Neolithic Stonehenge-type monuments that we know about in southern Sudan are about that old. So all of known Western human history, as far as we know, civilization, has been encompassed within one quarter of that cycle. In the East, you have the Kali Yuga, and of course, where could we go without this one? Many of us are understandably frightened about the millennial madness, as many of us see it, that's in this country and apparently in our White House. And so again, going back to my initial, and I'll just complete the list, there's Teilhard de Chardin that a few of us are quite familiar with, who more recently in the 20th century talked about the noosphere, this idea that there's in addition to the lithosphere and the biosphere, there's this knowledge and consciousness sphere that humanity represents with all those things. And even, I would say, in some ways, though we don't think of him this way, Karl Marx was essentially a prophetic visionary. It's as if he saw through to some sort of end state and then had a very hard time understanding how we would get from here to there, and you know, all kinds of mischief resulted in people basically not listening to his theory to try and figure out what to do. Because his theory says the thing just has to run its course. So it would seem plausible that whatever event is being foretold would at once validate all of the prophecies in retrospect, and yet therefore also necessarily turn out to be different than any of their culturally bound interpretations. Because if whatever is going to happen is going to fulfill them all, it's not going to fulfill them all in the way any of them think, because they're all different on the details. So, you know, it raises this question, what in the world could happen that would at once be sufficient to fulfill our collective psychic experience of the end of the world, while at the same time allowing a new world to be born? As Terence McKenna said, how could this happen in a happy way? So, the only thing I can imagine that would fulfill both conditions would be an economic collapse and subsequent transformation of the global monetary system. This would be the end of the world, because most people are living in the symbolist world. So that world would end with great emotional consternation. And yet, if that world was transformed, we would suddenly have removed the obstacles to dealing with most of the problems that we actually have to address. But what I'm suggesting is that it's there's something that the metaphor, the octave that one's talking about in chemistry is also there sort of in psychology. It's as if the individual experience of psychospiritual death and rebirth somehow has to be repeated at the collective scale in order for us to make this transformation. Even those of us that are sympathetic to Teilhard's vision of the noosphere don't experience ourselves that way every day walking around. I experience myself as this skin-encapsulated ego. I have these ideas about collective consciousness. It may be that the only way we can actually get there is through some sort of collective psychological crisis that we all go through together, and that this is so built into the collective knowledge. Are we at the end of that tape?
Yeah. Shit.
Oh, you got it. Okay. You can cut the line. I meant to stop a while ago. That it's as if this event casts a shadow backwards in time. And that shadow is so powerful that people glimpse it, and their glimpse is understood to be so important that cultures validate it and elevate it. And these become prophecies. But then the cultures get hold of this and, you know, interpret it through the lens of what they're able to understand. And so it gets distorted. But at the same time, if it was necessary for the world to do this, then in a certain sort of weird loop back, the fundamentalist Christians who are so waiting for the rapture that they're pushing it to happen would actually be fulfilling a necessary function to bring it about. That, you know, this weird, like, loop, it would be necessary to happen so they would be right, even if they turned out probably to be wrong in their particular inflection of what was going to happen that was making them, you know, anxious for it to happen. So I want to just end with another possible contemporary prophecy, which was 2001 A Space Odyssey, and particularly this image, which was remarkably like, it can be shown astronomically, and I won't go into it tonight, that the winter solstice in 1999, which is essentially Y2K, 10 days before Y2K, was the dawning of the age of Aquarius, astronomically, which would make that year zero, and we're now in year five, which kind of makes sense. It was interesting that until Y2K, nobody could see past it. And since then, we're all of a sudden, oh God, we're in this next century, what happens? And we're kind of looking around going, well, shit, I wasn't ready for this. And, you know, all of a sudden, we're in it. But this is an image I made for that solstice, which is remarkably similar to that that one from 2001. And what this depicts is a full moon, and in fact, an eclipse. No, that one was an eclipse. This was a full moon at perigee on the solstice. So what it means is that on the winter solstice in 1999, the moon was bigger and brighter than it gets in about 100 years. But it means the Earth, the Sun, the Moon, and the galactic equator were lined up in a straight line on the winter solstice, 1999, 10 days before the moment that global consciousness picked as the fold point in time. Now, it actually happened again on the summer solstice in 2001, which is why I say that 2001 may have been this sort of strange prophecy. Because there was another alignment almost identical to what that little picture I showed, that piece of computer graphics, which was the eclipse immediately preceding 9/11. And an eclipse on the solstice, and then there was another eclipse of the moon like 10 days before 9/11. So this is that sort of vision sequence. And I haven't done the animation on it yet. But, that was where I, as much as I decided to do tonight. So we have time for some questions and conversation. I expect that in some combinations it will probably go pretty late tonight. Anybody is welcome to leave whenever they've had their fill. I think what we should do is maybe get up, have a little stretch, get some food, And those that want to can come back in here and we'll talk some more, and those that want to chat with each other can do that, and we'll go on with the evening that way. Thank you all very much for coming. I've been preparing to do this for at least 10 or 15 years. And it was remarkable when I actually sat down. I've been writing quite a bit in the last month. I've got, you know, half a dozen 5 to 10 page pieces that I've produced. But these slides were put together in about 48 hours. I mean, a lot of the obvious graphics go back a long way, but and I'm really feeling, I think, what I'm sensing is that we're at the moment now where I need to put this out in the culture, and so I need to produce it really rapidly. And so I'm really, this is my focus, and I'm trying to pull back from everything else and work on it.
Yay.